There's that classic, universally accepted piece of advice you always hear right before you have to give a presentation or like a speech.
Oh, yeah.
It goes something like, tell them what you plan to tell them, then tell them, and then tell them what you just told them.
Right, the Holy Trinity of public speaking. I mean, it creates this expectation of just, unambiguous clarity, which feels very comforting when you're standing up there, totally nervous, just wanting to make sure everyone understands your point.
Yeah, that advice might work beautifully for, say, a corporate quarterly earnings report.
Sure.
But if you're trying to share a compelling story or a narrative, it is a famously terrible strategy.
It really is. It ruins it.
So today we're diving into exactly why that is. We want to look at the underlying mechanics of how to keep an audience genuinely captivated.
Which is so crucial.
Right. And to do that, we're exploring some brilliant insights from Dr. Stephen D. Mathewson's work on narrative public speaking, specifically, his master class on shaping and outlining Old Testament narratives.
And, even if you never plan to step foot behind a pulpit, the psychology of human attention we're pulling from this is universally applicable.
Oh, totally. Any presentation, any project post-mortem at work, even just a story you tell at a dinner party.
Exactly. Because to truly engage people, a speaker has to make very deliberate decisions about the architecture of their message.
Right.
And you cannot build a compelling structure until you recognize, the fatal flaw in how most of us default to presenting information.
Which is that we're terrified of it.
We are terrified of the narrative form, so we try to tame it.
And we tame it by turning these rich, sweeping stories into, well, bulleted lists of self-help principles.
Yes, the bullet points. It's tragic.
It really is. Mathewson looks at how speakers frequently handle these epic historical narratives, and honestly, it's almost
It's
comical.
a little painful to read, yeah.
Like one speaker looked at Exodus 3, the profound, earth-shattering story of Moses at the burning bush, and boiled it down to three keys to impossible living.
Oh, wow. Yeah, another one he mentions took Genesis 45. This is where Joseph is navigating immense trauma, dealing with his painful past.
Right, highly emotional stuff.
And they just listed out behavioral techniques for putting the past behind you.
Just techniques.
Right. And the sheer tension of Abraham's test in Genesis 22 gets flattened into four principles on faith.
Or Joseph fleeing from Potiphar's wife in Genesis 39, becoming four reasons to say no to sexual temptation.
It just strips all the visceral humanity and tension right out of the room.
It does. I mean, okay, let's unpack this. I'm imagining watching a gripping murder mystery thriller, right?
Okay, I like this.
But like 5 minutes in, the director pauses the movie, walks onto the screen, and says, "By the way, the butler did it because he has unresolved childhood trauma. Now let's watch the remaining 2 hours to see his trauma play out."
That would be unbearable to watch.
You've entirely killed the magic. I mean, you've robbed me of the experience of discovery.
You have. And you've also completely failed to do justice to the original author's strategy.
Ugh.
Well, when you shrink a narrative into a list, you're essentially hijacking a complex story. You're using it as a cheap prop to support principles that honestly probably came from somewhere else entirely.
Oh, interesting. So it's not even native to the text.
Right. Speakers often take these highly structured doctrinal ideas from the New Testament, for example, and just read them backward into these raw ancient Old Testament texts.
Which ignores the unique message of the narrative itself.
Exactly. I mean, human brains are wired for tension and release. A list provides unearned cognitive closure without any of the necessary tension.
Okay, but I have to push back a little on this idea that giving the answers away is always bad.
Sure, go for it.
Doesn't deductive reasoning, giving the conclusion up front and then explaining it, doesn't that make things incredibly clear?
It does. It does make things clear.
Because we are constantly told in business and communication that clarity is the ultimate goal. Like, if I give you my thesis in the first 10 seconds, you never have to guess what I'm talking about, right?
Deduction absolutely provides clarity. And to be fair, certain types of communication use deduction brilliantly.
Okay.
If we look at the New Testament epistles, for example, they often state the big idea in the very first sentence.
Right. Paul does that a lot.
He does. But the mechanism holding the audience's attention there isn't narrative suspense. It is tension through disbelief.
Tension through disbelief. Wait, meaning the audience hears the thesis and internally argues with it.
Precisely. Imagine you're unpacking 2 Corinthians 12, where the Apostle Paul makes this wild claim that his weakness is actually a profound advantage.
Right, which sounds crazy.
Exactly. If you state that right up front, The audience's immediate internal reaction is, wait, no, it isn't. Weakness gets you fired. Weakness gets you hurt.
Yeah, I don't see how weakness is a good thing at all.
Right. And that internal pushback creates a different kind of tension. They are leaning in because they want you to prove this highly controversial claim.
Oh, I see. So the tension shifts from what is going to happen next to how can that possibly be true?
Yes. But with a narrative, deduction risks being deeply, painfully boring.
Because there's no argument to make.
Exactly. If there is no controversial claim to prove, and you just give away the moral of the story before the story even starts, there's zero incentive for the listener's brain to stay engaged. They already have the prize.
Which means we have to embrace the alternative.
Which is induction.
Right. Because stories naturally operate inductively. The details build up layer by layer, and the resolution remains completely unknown until the final moments.
Yes. And Mathewson introduces this wonderful concept for this called strategic delay.
Strategic delay. I love that term.
The big idea should never be front-loaded. You have to save it for the final aha moment.
But executing that delay, it requires overcoming a massive psychological hurdle for the speaker, doesn't it?
Oh, a huge one. The fear of being misunderstood.
Yeah, Mathewson actually shares a very vulnerable admission about this in the source.
He does, yeah.
He says that early in his career, he was so terrified his congregation would miss the point of the text that he deeply distrusted the story form.
He just couldn't let it do its work.
Right. He would preach on 1 Samuel 5 through 7, and out of sheer anxiety, he would announce his conclusion before he even started.
Delicious.
He'd say, God is not just a power source you can exploit, but a powerful person you must worship.
Whoa.
Yeah. He completely skipped to the last chapter and gave away the ending.
That fear of the audience not getting it is so universal, we feel irresponsible if we don't hold their hand the whole way.
Right, like we're failing if we aren't being totally explicit from minute one.
But true mastery of communication requires you to live in the unresolved tension alongside your audience.
To live in the tension.
Yes. To master strategic delay, you have to withhold judgment. Consider the brilliant storytelling in Judges 17 and 18.
Okay, let's look at that one.
The narrator introduces a man named Micah, who has a house of God.
Now, on the surface, that sounds incredibly pious. If I'm listening to that, I'm thinking Micah is the moral center of the story.
And the author lets you believe that.
Right.
The narrator meticulously details Micah's religious setup, making it sound so official.
Uh-huh.
And it isn't until the very last verse of this massive two-chapter saga that a clarifying detail drops like an anvil.
What's the detail?
The text finally reveals. All the time, the house of God was in Shiloh.
Oh, meaning Micah's entire religious enterprise was a counterfeit.
Completely disconnected from where God actually was.
That is wild.
Right. So a wise speaker taking an audience through that narrative relies on strategic delay. You don't pause in chapter 17 to warn the audience that Micah is a fraud.
You don't say, hey guys, spoiler alert.
Exactly. You reserve your commentary. You let them live in the illusion, so the tragedy of that final revelation hits them naturally, exactly as the original author intended.
You let the story drop the hammer.
Yes.
There is another fascinating example of this from the famous David and Bathsheba narrative in Tecent Sam.
Oh, that's a great one.
Yeah, so in chapter 11, Bathsheba's husband, Uriah, is brought back from the front lines. David is trying to cover up his affair, hoping Uriah will go home and sleep with his wife.
To hide the pregnancy.
Right. But Uriah refuses. He literally sleeps on the ground, saying he cannot enjoy the comforts of home while his men are camped out in the open country fighting a war.
And the instinct for a communicator there is to immediately stop the narrative momentum.
To preach about it.
Right. To deliver a 5-minute lecture on Uriah's incredible integrity, because it is a shining example of noble character.
But the mechanism of strategic delay dictates that you hold that card. You don't linger on Uriah's nobility in the moment.
You wait.
You let the story play out until David reaches his absolute moral collapse, orchestrating Uriah's murder.
And then?
Then, at the climax, you bring Uriah's noble words back up. The contrast between the grit and honor of the soldier sleeping in the dirt and the deceit of the king hiding in his palace, it's devastating.
It is. It hits so much harder. Now, there are rare exceptions where the story itself gives away the ending immediately.
Oh, really? Like when?
Take the story of Achan in Joshua 7. The text tells us right up front who committed the sin that brought disaster on the camp. We know Achan is guilty from verse 1.
Okay, so the who did it is gone. But even then, the suspense doesn't disappear. It just changes shape.
Yeah,
right. We are asking who did it. Mm. We're anxiously waiting to see how will he be discovered.
Yes, The tension is still driving the car. The ultimate takeaway from all these narrative mechanics is a simple, unbreakable rule.
What's the rule?
When the tension is over, the message is over.
Wow.
And that remains true whether you have physically finished speaking or not. The moment the audience's brain achieves that cognitive closure, they check out.
When the tension is over, the message is over. That is profound.
It really changes how you prep.
But it brings us to a massive practical roadblock for anyone listening.
Okay, what's the roadblock?
If I agree that I have to keep the audience in suspense and I commit to speaking inductively, you know, holding the reveal, how do I actually write my notes?
Oh, the outline.
Yeah. If my outline hides the main point until the end, won't I just confuse myself while I'm standing up there looking at a piece of paper that doesn't state the thesis?
That is such a common anxiety, but it stems from conflating the speaker's needs with the listener's experience.
How so?
We falsely assume that the outline we write to keep ourselves on track must be the exact same structure we verbally hand to the audience.
Oh, I see. Which leads to some genuinely awful outlining habits.
It really does.
There is a hilarious classroom anecdote in Mathewson's book about this. It's about a preaching student named Dean, originally called Rod in the text, though Dean apparently didn't mind his real name being used as a cautionary tale.
Which is very brave of him.
Right. So Dean had to present an outline for the epic David and Goliath showdown in 1 Samuel 17.
And you can almost predict how a nervous student is going to handle a text that famous.
They over-engineer it.
Completely.
He absolutely over-engineered it. Dean stands up and proudly presents this highly alliterated, perfectly symmetrical outline.
Let's hear it.
Point one, Goliath challenges God's people. Point two, Saul cowers with God's people. Point three, David conquers for God's people.
Oh, wow.
Challenges, cowers, conquers. It's so neat and tidy.
And utterly divorced from the grit of a life or death battle against a giant.
Exactly. And the professors did not hold back. Hadn't Robinson sat in silence, letting the tension build in the classroom, and then growled that Dean's outline sounded like a book titled Simple Sermons for Sunday Evening.
Ouch.
You can just feel the sympathetic cringe from the other students.
I'm cringing right now.
Another professor, Dwayne Litvin, added the final blow. He said he's afraid you might actually go out and preach that sermon.
That is brutal.
Yeah.
But the humor masks a very serious structural flaw.
Right.
Dean created an outline designed to be memorable for the audience, prioritizing clever alliteration over narrative flow. But the audience shouldn't be memorizing your outline. They should be swept up in the story.
Which introduces my absolute favorite analogy for this entire process.
The house framing.
Yes. Mathewson talks about helping his contractor friend, John, frame a house. Mathewson has his hammer and his 2x4s, and he is obsessing over the precision.
As an academic would.
Right. He's trying to align these wooden studs perfectly to a 16th of an inch, agonizing over the aesthetics of the raw wood.
Yeah.
And John finally walks by, sees what he's doing, and says, "You're not building a piano."
You're not building a piano. It's brilliant. It is rough framing. It needs to be structurally sound. It needs to hold weight, but nobody is ever going to see it.
Because it's all covered by sheetrock.
Exactly. Your outline is your skeleton. You absolutely need it to stand up, or the entire presentation collapses into a rambling mess.
Right.
But the audience should never see the skeleton. It is a functional roadmap for you, the speaker. It is not a syllabus you hand out to the listeners.
Mm. Okay, so if we accept that the outline is functional framing, we have to look at the specific rules for building it.
We do.
How do you create a roadmap that keeps you on track without ruining the inductive journey for your audience?
Well, the first rule requires a bit of a mental shift. While the story you tell works inductively, building suspense to a climax, your private outline actually works deductively.
Meaning, my main point on the paper isn't what I say at the beginning of a section, it's the destination I am trying to reach by the end of that section.
Yes. Your notes are guiding you toward the reveal. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, next to a main point in your outline, you might simply write the instruction, "Develop inductively."
Just as a cue to yourself.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That physical note reminds your panicked brain that this is a movement of thought, not an announcement. You are not going to look at the crowd and say, "Moving on to point number one."
The actual phrasing of those points in your notes is critical, too.
Very much so.
Because my instinct when prepping for a meeting is just to jot down a couple of keywords to jog my memory. A bullet point that says, you know, Q3 budget or the problem of idolatry.
Oh, that's dangerous.
Yeah, Mathewson explicitly warns against this. He insists that outline points must be written in complete full sentences.
And we have all experienced the terror of the keyword failure. We call those short phrases caption surveys.
Right. And they seem fine at the time.
They seem sufficient when you're sitting calmly at your desk.
Mm.
But public speaking is a high adrenaline environment. Your heart rate is up. Your working memory is compromised.
The analogy Mathewson uses is so vivid for this. He says, relying on a partial statement lets the thought slip through your mind like a slick, rain-covered football.
That is exactly what it feels like.
You look down at your notes, you see the word idolatry, and your stressed brain suddenly cannot remember the brilliant, nuanced point you wanted to make about it.
And you just end up fumbling the idea and rambling.
Yeah. But a full sentence forces you to clarify the thought entirely before you ever step on stage.
It acts as an anchor. It tells you exactly what you're saying about the topic, not just what the topic is.
Okay, but if my notes are full of these definitive full sentences, how do I transition between them naturally? I really don't want to sound like a robot reading a manual.
Right. To fix that, you shift how you conceptualize the structure. Stop thinking of them as bullet points in a ledger and start thinking of them as scenes or movements in a film.
Scenes in a film.
Yeah. If you were presenting the narrative of Samuel confronting Saul in 1 Samuel 15, the outline point just marks the threshold of a new scene. You transition the way a camera transitions by moving the action and the characters forward into the next environment.
And keeping the number of scenes manageable is key.
Very important.
Yeah.
Mathewson suggests the strict 2-to-4-point rule.
Any more than 4 main movements and the structure becomes too convoluted.
The audience will just get lost in the weeds.
Mm.
Most narratives naturally condense into a clean 2-point structure anyway.
Oh, really? Just 2 points.
Yeah. Perfectly mirroring the crisis, which is the core problem being faced, and the resolution, the ultimate outcome.
Let's actually look at how this skeleton functions in practice. We can examine how Mathewson outlines that massive, sprawling 2-chapter narrative from Judges 17 and 18 about Micah and his fake religion.
It is a massive amount of text, but the structural framing he uses is beautifully simple. 2 main points.
Okay. Point 1 represents the crisis. In his notes, written as a full sentence, it reads, Micah and the Danites turned from God to idols.
And crucially, the speaker doesn't announce that sentence.
Right.
That is the destination the speaker is driving toward.
Underneath that main destination, he has subpoints that simply guide him through the scenes. Scene A, Micah constructs an unauthorized religious system.
Uh-huh.
Scene B, the Danites abandon their God-given land to head for Laish. Scene C, the Danites steal Micah's idol on their way.
So the speaker simply tells these scenes as a cohesive story. As the audience listens, they slowly begin to realize the crisis unfolding.
Then once the crisis is established, the roadmap shifts to the resolution.
Right.
Point 2, the resolution is written in the notes as a result, Micah and the Danites did not experience the presence of God.
You have guided the audience through the problem and the tragic outcome. But the most important element, the big idea, is still hidden.
The big idea is tucked away as the very final subpoint in the entire outline. It's saved for the absolute climax.
Right at the end.
The speaker delivers the tragic resolution of the story and only then drops the aha moment. When we turn from God to idols, we miss out on the presence of God.
It's brilliant because the audience feels like they arrived at that conclusion simultaneously with the speaker. They actually experience the journey.
So whether you are literally extracting ancient wisdom from a text, delivering a keynote, or just trying to explain a complex new strategy to your team, the formula for keeping human beings hooked is strategic delay.
Build the tension.
You have to build the tension. You must hide your structural wooden studs behind the sheetrock of a well-told story.
Yes.
And you have to trust the narrative enough to save that major realization for the very end.
So for everyone listening, consider the next time you have to persuade someone or share vital information.
Yeah, think about it.
It might be a formal presentation, or it could simply be a long, high-stakes email. Are you defaulting to deduction? Are you giving away the ending in your very first sentence simply out of fear that they won't understand you?
Most of us do.
But what would happen if you trusted the story form instead? What if you intentionally withheld that big idea, carefully built the tension, and let them experience the genuine thrill of discovering the conclusion right alongside you?
Remember that tell them advice we started with. The next time you have a narrative to share, throw it out the window.
Yeah.
Be the director who keeps the murder mystery a mystery until the final frame. You're not building a piano, you're building an experience. Thanks for diving deep with us today.